The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Before the 4th of July weekend, and I'm not quite sure how people are going to react this year. Politically, I look at this country and the mess it's in, and one has to look back, and I think it is time that we all look way back to what the founding fathers had in mind, and I don't think any of them would like what's going on now. In fact, I'd bet on it. As you know, we've been doing a lot lately. Thanks to Frank Chile and Major George Filer, of course. In terms of disclosure work, William Tompkins has been on this program a number of times. He will be back on this Wednesday for another installment of his remarkable life. He's 93 years old. He has been at the top. He has been in the darkest of dark projects and has been telling us things that I think many of you never thought you'd hear. Herbert Dorsey has made some wonderful contributions on this program. We've heard the story of Jim Oglesby and the UFO ET involvement with the early Apollo launches in Florida, Cape Canaveral. We're going to hear from Jim Oglesby again this Thursday night as well. I think we're going to wrap his story up, and it gets to be very, very interesting. As you know, disclosure is rather like a puzzle. Pieces. We're getting a few more pieces as time goes by to put the puzzle together. One of the bigger pieces of the puzzle we haven't spoken to in too many years is Dr. Michael Sala. He has a PhD from the University of Queensland in Australia in government affairs. He is a remarkable source of all kinds of information in the areas of black ops and hidden projects and technology. He is coming to us now from Hawaii, and I assume he is standing by. Are you there, Michael?
I am. Aloha, Jeff. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's only been, what, 15 years?
Well, glad to be back.
Yeah, you sound better than ever, actually. Very good. Now, you've been listening to some of the programs that we've been doing here with Bill Tompkins, I think, and others. The bigger question, I guess, is, where are we in disclosure? There was a big push, 8 or 10 years ago. And at this point, after all the information that we have access to, all the things we've learned, all the data on the internet, all the pictures, all the digital and video recordings, do we really care about the government telling us anything anymore? Do we even trust the government? Haven't we really found out virtually most of what we need to know? I mean, I know I don't need anybody to tell me that we're being visited, have been visited, and will continue to be visited by any number of intelligent life forms. Where are we in this whole disclosure thing?
think, Jeff, it really is important to just understand that there are two different types of disclosure that we really need to kind of understand here. One is public disclosure, and that is the kind of work you've been doing and others have been doing in getting all of these witnesses to come forward to talk about their experiences, the whistleblowers, the documents that have been leaked. All of these things are part of a public disclosure process, and that's something that we in the general public hear about all the time, and certainly I've really enjoyed listening to the disclosures recently with Bill Tompkins, because that gave me some really important pieces of the puzzle that I was trying to understand, and he kind of filled that in.
He's remarkable, yeah.
He's incredible, yeah. I mean, he's really... I met him in San Diego just because once I heard his testimony and how it all kind of lined up with Bob Wood's experiences mm-hmm. there mm-hmm. at McDonnell Douglas, I knew that this guy was very real and had incredible information to share. And you know, everything I've heard from him is just really an important piece of the puzzle. I think he, more than kind of many whistleblowers, has experienced enough things to really redefine how we understand the world and history.
Right.
So you have people like Bill who really are part of this kind of public disclosure process. And then there's official disclosure, and like you said, it's like, well, you know, it's the officials, whether it's Obama or John Kerry or whether it's David Cameron. Or
don't say her name. It's okay.
Right, okay. So, like, any of these officials coming forward and saying, well, yes, this is what's been going on, and sure, that would make a difference for people in the professional class who are too frightened to talk about this. I went through that myself. I worked at a university 2001 when I heard the Disclosure Project press conference with Stephen Greer.
Yeah.
And heard all those witnesses, I knew it was real. As soon as I heard those witnesses, I read, you're not going to have 21 people with those kinds of backgrounds talking about this kind of issue
right,
and
right.
a cover-up without it being genuine. But all of the colleagues I spoke to and even my superiors in the university just didn't want to hear it. And so, you know, because for them it was like professional suicide.
What a strange, what a strange paradox. Here we were brought up to think that universities are the cutting edge, the leading source of exploration of the world around us and the world within us. And yet, in point of fact, universities very often are they're the gatekeepers. They don't let stuff out. They know they don't want to go there. They're grant-oriented. They are afraid. You expressed it perfectly. And what a strange and sad and sorry situation when the opposite should be true.
Yes, exactly. And it's very funny because I was actually part of that world. Up until I heard Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, I was pretty much a conventional academic scholar in international politics, you know, writing books, doing research papers, doing fieldwork conferences, all of that sort of thing. And when I heard Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project, I knew that this was really very important. But it was like I was kind of out in the limb, because it was like I had to toe the line if I wanted to maintain a career in this field. And so I had to make a pretty difficult choice whether I was going to continue doing this. But the thing that really kind of convinced me that I had to go forward was that I was teaching at American University, and I was teaching in the graduate program there. And these students, they were paying like $30,000 a year to hear the latest and the best information about international affairs. And honestly, after I heard the Disclosure Project press conference, I felt that, well, I cannot talk about international affairs in the way I used to talk about or teach without sharing this information. Otherwise, I mean, I'd be a hypocrite. Because I knew that these kids were paying, you know, $30,000 a year to hear what was really going on, and I can't talk about it. It was like I said, well, no, I can't do that. And I tried to kind of work out some arrangement with the university so that I could continue to do research in this field. But after 3 years of trying to compromise and navigate my way through a really tightening room more space there in terms of what the university was allowing me to do and say in this area. Eventually, they kind of cut the strings, and I was out there on my own. But that was really probably the best thing for me.
Doomed by your own mortality and conscience.
Well, that's right. Yeah, it really is ultimately conscience, and any teacher or university professor, if you can't stand in front of a group of students who are paying top dollar to be there, and basically you can't tell them what you know to be true, it's better not to be part of that. And I'm glad I was forced out of the university system, because I think I would have died a slow death if I had just continued teaching what I was teaching without sharing this information.
Well, as a teacher, as an educator, as a leader, here you have these young people sitting there literally putting their most sacred trust to a degree in your hands. Teach us. Let us know what's important for us to build our lives around. And that's a very, very heady kind of a thing to consider. And I say damn the universities, for doing this kind of thing to you and to many others. Who are these people? They're so, consumed with the state and the money game that they just can't do their jobs. And it's a fallacy. I used to have people come on this program and urge parents not to pay $30,000 or $50,000 a year, or now get a student loan and go into debt over $100,000 to spend 4 years. You're not going to come away with a legitimate understanding of the world around you in many cases. That they would actually do better by just listening to this program for a year and reading the website or a couple websites and educate themselves. That's what we're supposed to learn. If they have a specialty, that's something else. If it's hard science, that's something else. But any general studies students now are really kind of, they're out of luck. They're going to get the government approved curriculum, and that's going to be about it.
Right, exactly. It's like you need to make a choice whether you're going to follow what you know to be true or follow the path that leads to kind of career success. And there are so many people that have taken that path of just, putting on the blinders and not paying attention to what's really going on, because, they want to succeed in this narrowly defined path, whether it's in international politics or whether it's in economics whether it's as a career politician or whatever it is, and they put the blinkers on. I think after doing that and not bothering or not kind of following your conscience, I think it is a slow death. And so I'm not surprised that many of these people along the path, they just become very corrupt and very easily controlled by these puppeteers behind the scenes.
Did the university endeavor to smear you in any way for your basic acceptance and interest in the field of the paranormal, of ETs, of extraterrestrials, of contactees, Adamski, and forward from that, of abductees? This, because it's such a big part of life on this planet. And yet these people who run around again as gatekeepers trying to keep the door shut on it, I don't know how they sleep at night, some of them. Did any of them try to put you down on your way out the door?
Oh, well, yeah, definitely. There was, in 2004, I had been told, in 2001, after I said that I was interested in this topic, I was told, well, as long as I don't make too much of a public impact and associate with the universities with it, then I'd be okay. So they said, yeah, research it on your own, but kind of make it more of a hobby, don't associate us with it.
Wow.
And that kind of, that kind of really limited my options there. But eventually what happened was that in 2004, the Washington Post did a feature story on the research I'd done on President Eisenhower meeting with extraterrestrials at Edwards Air Force Base in 1954.
Uh-huh.
And basically the university just kind of went ballistic. They just said, no, we can't you know, we can't be associated with this in any way. We don't want you to be with us anymore. So, you know, we're summarily terminating the program that you're working on, and at the end of your appointment, we're not going to renew it. And,
wow.
And that was it. So basically, August of 2004, I had to essentially leave the country.
Wow. Okay. Well, that was then, and this is now. Are we, now you have a background in international government affairs that is really terrific. Did you ever, I gotta step aside off the paranormal track for just a minute here. Did you ever imagine that you would see, that we would see what has happened to this country in the last 15, 20 years at the rate at which it has happened, where we are now? This is incredible. You got the Bushes, George Herbert Walker Bush, in the White House, and if Reagan had died like he was supposed to, he would have been two-term president. And you got Bush Jr., two terms, and you got Bill and Hillary, two terms, and now we're faced with the Clintons for eight more years. This is nuts. I mean, it really is crazy.
Right. It's very interesting that kind of... the Disclosure Project conference only a few months after that was followed by the 9/11.
Yes.
And just those things just kind of like completely changed everyone's world, really. And the effect of 9/11, I mean, we all know what that has led to, but it really is a very different America. You know, I came out here from Australia in 1996. And by 2001, 2002, it definitely had started to change dramatically. I mean, just the way in which people were thinking and the whole war on terror, this it was just inconceivable that somehow war, which had always been understood to be something that was directed against organized political entity, suddenly became this endless... policy against something that was not related in any way to any kind of state, but just this endless war against terrorism. And it was like, that's crazy. That's certainly not in the tradition of the United States, not from what I had studied.
And all proffered and implemented by a controlled, compliant, willing mainstream media, which is now more than ever doing the bidding of its owners. I mean, it's not even a fair fight. It's really an obscenity what they're doing. And I came from that. I got away from it.
Yeah, it's really funny. I mean, as I said, up until 2001, I really thought that reading the Washington Post, the New York Times, the LA Times, that gave me a kind of very neutral perspective of what's really going on around the world. And now I think just, you know, how foolish I was at the time to think that. But I think I was probably very typical of your average academic that really believed that these mainstream papers were really telling you what's going on. And it's only when you actually work in this field and look at the alternative media and what's being put out and the work you've been doing over the years that your eyes open and see just how controlled the mainstream media is.
Yeah, and by virtue of that control, the public, and now we have really two generations of younger people who are being brought up not to think and be proactive. They're being brought up to react to various stimuli. They've now become addicted also to smartphones and technology. There's a whole, it's not a 180 necessarily, but it's damn close. There's a reversal to what young people were like in the 70s and 80s. They're compliant. They're passive. There are exceptions, and many of them are listening to this program right now. And you folks, I've talked to some of them, and they say, you know, you're right. And we're surrounded by these people our own age who can't put this smartphone down, and all they do is look at it. And if they get messages, they're happy or they're sad, and it's crazy. It's just amazing. And if we think it's bad now, Michael Sella, if we're around in another 3 or 4 years, it's going to be double or treble what it is now. The dominance, the conditioned response, our young people are, I'm sorry, but they're missing out on an awful lot of life with a capital L. They're just not getting it anymore.
I think that there is this kind of lack of critical analysis of what's going on around, and to me, in having worked in this field of international politics, it's all about just being able to open your mind to the different levels of analysis of what is going on, and I think that if people are not prepared to go to that deeper level, they're just going to always stay on a superficial understanding of what's going on,
yeah,
which is driven by the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, whether it just comes with the years, wisdom, age, or just having an open mind, I think eventually we all have the opportunity to embrace another way of looking at things. And I just hope that the younger generation kind of like open up to the information that's coming out now through the alternative media about what is really going on. Because I think you're right, if it doesn't happen very quickly in the next few years, we might get to the point where it really isn't reversible anymore, that it really is a question of getting as many people to open up to what's really happening,
right,
at the deepest level right now.
Very well said. I would direct all of you to Michael's website, exopolitics.org, and take a look around. It's a wonderful blend of all kinds of things. You're feeling about young people is I think absolutely correct. If we go one more generation without somehow turning this around, and yes, everyone says we've got the internet now, look at all the information on there. Okay, but where do the majority of younger people spend their time? Facebook, right? Playing games, texting, messaging, sexting, whatever they're doing. It's more than a lifestyle now. It used to be said that television, remember that old saying, television is the message. Well, now it's the digital age is the message. That's what's dominant. We're just not teaching our young people to get out there and question things anymore. They're, as you said, they're floating along and no problem. They get their little sound bites, they're talking heads, and they think they're informed. And they're not. And furthermore, they don't understand the values, and capital V for value, the values that we grew up with. They don't speak that language. They've never been exposed to it, except maybe on a TV sitcom as some anachronistic joke. I hate to be too frank about this, but I'm not too optimistic right now. I wish I could say otherwise. Anyway, hold on if you would, Michael. We'll come right back and take a look at the paranormal aspects of your research and your life and where you think that's going and where we are with that and some of the things that particularly intrigue you. That'll be fun to hear. Our guest is Dr. Michael Sala, and we shall continue. We are very fortunate, those of us who look at the world logically and objectively, to have an academician of Dr. Michael Sala's character and intelligence and wisdom on our side of the fence. There aren't enough people like him out there. So, Michael, what is it about this world of disclosure, we'll call it just for fun, that intrigues you the most? What are your top three or four areas of interest? There's so many, I couldn't even count them, but I particularly enjoy looking at people who put up videos of the Curiosity rover pictures, for example, pointing out the very non-natural, random kinds of angles and objects that appear to be of human or intelligent origin that are scattered all over the surface. It's like Mars was blown up on the surface and a vast civilization was just shattered into little pieces. There are too many strange things up there. That's one area for me of many, many, many. What are the things that that really intrigue you?
Well, the thing that really grabbed me from the very beginning was the meetings that President Eisenhower had with the extraterrestrials. And when I first heard about that, I was just totally amazed because I just had not thought that this could have happened to that extent, that not only was the whole UFO phenomenon very real, but that there were diplomatic negotiations occurring as far back as 1954. So that was something that when I first learned about that, that really just kind of got me going down a path where I just consumed as much information as I could find, you know, trying to corroborate, well, you know, did this really happen? Why did Eisenhower do it? What were the issues that were discussed at these secret meetings? And it certainly has evolved from there, but that was the issue that kind of really got my attention, the official diplomacy with the extraterrestrials.
That is a hallmark event, there's no question. We know now little bits and pieces, you know more than I, but it is alleged that Eisenhower was golfing in, I think, Palm Springs or somewhere, but was whisked away to Edwards to have this meeting, at least on one occasion, and the press was left behind. It was kind of funny when you think about it.
Yeah, there were just so many witnesses talking about different aspects of it. People that were actually working at Edwards Air Force Base, Air Force personnel that were kind of like subjected to this shutdown. All of a sudden they couldn't enter the base, they couldn't leave the base. So that was also something that was kind of discussed. And then you had the reports, you know, the famous report by Meade Lane, and then after that you had others coming forward talking about this incredible meeting where Eisenhower got to meet with the extraterrestrials, and just the fact that this occurred like 10 days before the Bravo test, which was the biggest hydrogen bomb test in U.S. history.
Yeah, our biggest.
And it was 15 megatons.
Which it was too damn big, that's how big it was.
Yeah, it's incredible, you know, that it was 1,000 times more powerful than the bomb that was dropped on, I think it was Nagasaki, the mm-hmm. second one, the smaller of the two. And that the extraterrestrials actually negotiated with the Eisenhower administration on this topic of developing thermonuclear weapons, and that this was something that Eisenhower's advisors discussed and debated, and the kind of story I got from various whistleblowers was that Eisenhower was very sympathetic to doing a deal, but that eventually he basically succumbed to his national security advisors that said, no, this was not a good idea, that we really needed these nuclear weapons for our own protection in case things with the extraterrestrials went south. So that was, you know, a fascinating part of U.S. history. And something that I think also is very important in terms of understanding why it was the whole extraterrestrial phenomenon was covered up, why it was that people were not told about this, that you had these negotiations occurring behind the scenes where some extraterrestrials really wanted the U.S. to abandon its nuclear weapons program and in exchange would basically help the U.S. and the rest of the world with kind of more quality of life issues, but that this was turned down by the national security apparatus.
Yeah, it's a great tragedy. We never should have gone into nuclear power, period, whether it was for weapons use or energy production. Just an horribly insane, unnecessary risk. It also is interesting, Eisenhower, 1954, There are reports that allege that Germany was contacted by perhaps a different group. I believe these were very tall ETs that Ike met. There was another group, apparently the reptilians, from what common... Well, we hear stories. The reptilians met with the Germans in the late 30s or mid-30s and made a deal with them that there was some technological exchanging going on for various things. It's hard to know what's real and what isn't. But you feel at this point in your research that the Eisenhower meeting, at least one, and there may have been two, I've heard that anyway, did take place. Have you been able to find any corroborating government data, any documents at all that would suggest that Ike didn't play a round of 18 holes on that day?
There was really just a lot of whistleblower testimony. Some investigation was done on the story that Eisenhower went to see a dentist.
The dentist story, of course. Yes.
Yeah, and that was found to be a cover story because the dentist, after he, he died, but there was no record of him having met Eisenhower or at least having treated Eisenhower. So there have been investigations trying to determine whether or not Eisenhower did actually have that treatment with the dentist, but you know that didn't happen as was said, and that clearly suggests it was a cover story. And then we have all of these whistleblowers who have come forward. There was this member of, I believe he was whether it was the New Hampshire or Maine, I can't remember which of the two states, but he was a member of one of those assemblies. Henry McElroy, and he said that he actually was given official documents talking about Eisenhower having met with extraterrestrials, and he said it was because he was with the one of the International Affairs Committee with the House, I believe it was New Hampshire, and that in his capacity, his official capacity, I think he was the chairman of that particular committee, and that he was given access to this document and got to read it, and that Eisenhower did have this meeting. So that document is something that he said that he saw, but he didn't have a record of it. But so that's about as close as I can think of any official document that these meetings did happen. All of the best material we'll have so far is just many whistleblowers.
Right, right. Okay, next up, Eisenhower, great starting point. From where did it lead? What fields opened up to you next? Where did you put your energy? That's a very intriguing way to start this whole business. So what came next?
Yeah, well, that was kind of really an outgrowth of my own background, academic background, because I actually did work in the field of diplomacy, doing second track diplomacy. That was actually one of the courses I was teaching at the university. So understanding how diplomacy works and complementing official diplomacy with citizen diplomacy, that was really one of the main things that the graduate students were very interested in at the time. Studying in the Peace and Conflict Resolution Program. So I was very interested in all forms of official diplomacy and how citizen diplomacy could complement that. And so as I'm reading through all of the material about these official meetings with extraterrestrials and how some agreements were reached with one group but not another group, that one group was willing to trade technology but another group was saying that no, we are too dangerous, we don't have the ethical development to kind of handle these technologies, that as I'm reading through all this, and then I'm coming across the whole contactee phenomenon, and I understood immediately, Jeff, that these were examples of citizen diplomacy. You know, the whole kind of George Adamski, George Van Tassel, Howard Menger, Orfeo Angelucci, there were so many of them in the 50s and the 60s. All of these five individuals were really citizen diplomats without really knowing it. But, you know, because I had taught that and was actually working in that field at the university, as I'm reading through these early contact cases, I understood that, okay, well, so we have both official diplomacy with extraterrestrials and we are having unofficial or citizen diplomacy with extraterrestrials. And I could understand why it was happening, you know, why one group of extraterrestrials that felt that the official diplomats and the Eisenhower administration weren't paying attention to what they were saying would choose to interact with these private citizens to tell them, well, you know, we're here, these are the things that we're concerned about, you know, you should tell people, you should share with the world what we are trying to help you get through and the danger of nuclear weapons. So these are the kind of stories that Adamski and Menger and the others were sharing.
I'm to the point, and have been to the point long ago actually, of believing that we will not respond, we will not be allowed to respond by the various governmental globalist agencies that run the show to any kind of overtures like this. I think we're reduced to hoping that somebody will come here, like 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still, and give us an ultimatum. I really think that's the only thing that'll work.
Well, it's really funny that you mentioned that, because I know they had that movie, I believe it was... I can't remember if it was Central Park or I think it was in the Washington Mall. You know,
correct. It was in D.C., yeah.
That's right. It was in D.C. And then you have, in 1952, kind of like soon after that incident or that movie, you have the Washington flyover. I think it was at two, three successive weekends in July. You have these flyovers. And at first, I thought that, well, you know, I thought these must be extraterrestrials, and this is all part of a kind of process to try and acclimate humanity to the presence of extraterrestrial life, and to also like get the establishment to negotiate or better understand, you know, what the extraterrestrials wanted the Eisenhower or the Truman administrations to do when it came to the whole issue of nuclear weapons. So that was my initial kind of analysis of that. But that changed when I came across these secret space program whistleblowers. Corey Good, William Tompkins, and also Clark McClelland has said pretty much the same thing, that the 1952 Washington flyover was not exclusively an extraterrestrial event.
Right.
That it involved Nazi flying saucers. So that was my other big kind of awakening moment, when I realized that, you know, these stories about the Nazis having escaped to Antarctica and having their own flying saucer program, that in fact this really did happen. And the more research I did and into these claims over the years, and then you have Corey Good coming forward, and then soon after that you have William Tompkins coming forward, and what made William Tompkins kind of so important was because he had that official background and he had the documents to substantiate that he was down there at the Naval Air Station in San Diego, part of these briefings where they were hearing about these Nazis working with extraterrestrials, establishing bases in Antarctica, and then you have the flyovers. And so that was another level of analysis that I really had to kind of like look at here, that it wasn't just a question of extraterrestrials interacting with governments, but it was also an issue of this breakaway civilization, this breakaway Nazi faction in Antarctica that had somehow succeeded in establishing a space program during the Second World War and afterwards developing it to the extent where now they could do flyovers of major capitals like Washington and New York City and pressure the American administration into negotiating certain deals, and that's where, and that's a very critical time, you know, that 1952, because of course that's when you have the establishment of the Bilderberg Group soon afterwards, and I think that this was all part of pretty much the same process by which these Nazis that had been able to successfully establish this breakaway civilization in Antarctica and South America were eventually able to kind of like exert greater and greater influence both economically and militarily.
Well, I don't know how much greater it could be. I mean, our NASA was a German program run by German scientists, administered by German scientists, and certainly propelled by German scientific rocketry and other aspects of potentially anti-gravitic knowledge and capabilities. The door is wide open on that. Clark's been a friend of mine, McClelland, 20 years, and I'm very concerned about him. I'm trying to get in touch with him now. His health faded very badly in the last year, but he did talk to me off air and on the program many times about the Germans who, Dr. Debus and Dannemeyer and all of them, running the American space program. The entire NASA program was essentially an outgrowth of World War II German technological genius. And whether or not they went to Antarctica and built their craft down there, I can't prove. We're still waiting for whistleblowers on that. But something very interesting happened. They came over here in 48, 47, 48, 46 in Operation Paperclip. You're talking about 1952, the reported German saucer overflight over Washington, D.C. We have photographs of that. I had a radar operator who was on duty in Washington on this program describing the whole event. And if you watch the, there's film of it too. Now I look at it differently. I say, well, maybe that's true. Maybe in 7 years, the Germans went down there and underground, and I believe Tompkins said that there were three large underground cities there. They were given one of them that was no longer being needed or used by extraterrestrials and set up shop there. And then we can fast forward to the alleged Antarctic German World War II outgrowth saucer program, 1958. And you know what I'm getting at, I think. In the period of 10 days, give or take, 1 or 2 days, three atomic bombs were exploded over the Antarctic. What the hell was that about, is the question I said to myself. Why? What are they doing down there? And especially three in 10 days. That's not a research profile. That's something else. That's a tactical profile. Very odd. And they were said to be high altitude bursts, not ground bursts. So what do you know about that, Michael, if much of anything?
Well, I know that there was that agreement reached between the major powers to develop the Antarctic as a kind of neutral zone where there wouldn't be any military bases and that it would be used exclusively for scientific purposes, that was agreed to in 58, and so the Antarctic Treaty was signed and then eventually ratified in 1961. But I think that happened after the atomic weapons were used. And this is something that I'm trying to still reconcile in my own mind, whether they were genuinely trying to destroy the Nazi bases down there, or whether it was a show to basically persuade the Soviets that the Americans had destroyed whatever Nazi facilities were down there at the time. Uh-huh. And so now Antarctica was a militarily kind of neutral zone, and that it would be used exclusively for scientific purposes, because everything that I've been researching in terms of different whistleblower testimonies and documents, both in the 40s and 50s, uh-huh, and subsequently, is that there have essentially been an uninterrupted Nazi or kind of affiliated programs in Antarctica that have been involving these secret space programs and these alliances with certain extraterrestrial groups, whether it's the kind of inner Earth Thulians or whether it's the reptilians.
Right, right. Well, we know now that we have, just last week, in fact, we sent a Canadian-built Twin Otter aircraft in minus 75 temperatures to the actual South Pole, where we have some kind of a telescope operation set up down there, to medevac two people, I think it was, turned out to be two. And I think they successfully did it. That was a very risky mission. But I got from that, and I think your research probably would substantiate my feeling that the Antarctic is rather littered with black ops projects, which are certainly military and scientific, or both. I think there's a lot going on down there that we're not being told about and never will be told about. You agree?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think that these events that have been involving Antarctica, I think that there is a definite connection to this breakaway Nazi group that was down there, that over the years, especially since the 1952 Washington flyover, that agreements had been reached with the military-industrial complex, which basically really incorporated and integrated a lot of the programs that had been established in Antarctica and began cooperating with these factions. Mm-hmm. What I find very interesting is the connection between Antarctica and South America. Bariloche in Argentina, I know you had Harry Cooper on this show a number of times, and I think he's kind of substantiated quite clearly that Hitler and Bormann did escape to down to Argentina, and I find it very interesting that Bariloche there is at the foot of the Andes, and I know that many people I've spoken to have said that there are these vast subterranean systems that go throughout the South America down into Antarctica. And so that would mean that Bariloche and the Andes would actually make a very good place for a kind of unofficial capital for this Nazi surviving breakaway group. And I find it very interesting that both President Eisenhower and both Obama have been down at Bariloche at critical periods. And Obama, of course, earlier this year was down there at the same time.
Very strange. Who else went down there? Carter? Somebody else went down there. Three presidents went down to this out-of-the-way place.
Theodore.
Teddy Roosevelt? No. Somebody more current than that. I'll figure it out. We have to take a break, Michael. Hold on. Back with hour two of our conversation with Dr. Michael Sala in just a few minutes. Don't go away.